Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Helmut. Coming up in this week's show, WFPL Stephanie Sanders continues her series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council.
Some laws get passed because they can. If you have enough votes, you can do things.
Also, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with Kirkpatrick Sale about his book, After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination.
Killing is not inherently an act, it could fairly be said, that is congenial with the human spirit. That seems to be the modern psychological opinion.
And WFPL's Heidi Caravan talks about living with cancer with NPR's My Cancer blogger, Leroy Sievers.
What it does do is make me sit and, you know, for an hour or so each day and think about my cancer and sort of stop and reflect on it. And there's some days where that's all fine. There are some days where I just don't want to do that. You know, you want a little denial every now and then.
Now the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Helmut. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Julie Goodwin talks with Dr. Michael Greger about avian flu and his new book on the topic. First, though, we continue our series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council. Over the past several weeks, WFPL's Stephanie Sanders has talked with representatives about their thoughts on merger and how effectively the council's working. We continue this week with representatives from District 16, 17, and 18. Stephanie spoke with District 16 Councilman Kelly Downard about how the council's operating. He says a new council needs time to settle into its role.
Now that you've done that, do you think it is working properly?
No. We have a ways to go still. But one of my goals is to try to make sure that, and I don't mean to say this disparagingly, but I would like to not have Metro government turn into Washington and Frankfurt, where everything's very partisan. You try to win as opposed to accomplishing really good laws. And our job on the council is to legislate, pass laws that affect thousands of people. We should do it thoughtfully. And at the same time, we don't have to get along, but we have to be able to do that in a manner that has some respect for each other.
That was one of the things I was going to bring up a little later, but we'll talk about it now. Okay. Clearly, you think it is polarized. How do you think it ended up that way?
Well, I think there is there are a lot of reasons. Everyone points fingers. I think we try to do things, we pass some laws because, as I've told people in my district, some laws get passed because they can't. If you have enough votes, you can do things. Now, we started out the first couple of years, I think, trying to determine what is the right thing. Coalitions were formed all over the place. You look back to the very controversial laws that we passed. There were no party line votes on any of those things. Now it seems like we end up being more party line than we should. And I think that's wrong. I think we're not doing the work that we should do as legislators, and I'm working hard to try to change that.
But wouldn't some people say that's the way it's done in this country? I mean, is there a way to change that? Because, like you said, that's what Frankfurt has fallen into, and that's what Washington, D.C. has fallen into as well.
Well, if that's the way it's done, then I should resign. I do not buy that one second. There are people of goodwill on this council, and it doesn't matter whether they're what party they're in. Once we all decide to come together and decide what to do, which we think is the best way to pass laws, the best laws to make, adjust them properly. It doesn't have anything to do with what party you are. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you're city or county. But there are all kind of divisions that people like to make. The newspaper is one of the worst. They would love to make us divided any way they can, and that's just wrong. We have to continue to concentrate on the things we agree on, work toward some kind of resolution of the things we don't agree on. And yes, there are going to be some things we just absolutely don't agree on. That's the way it is.
Do you think enough people in Louisville know what Metro Council is and know what goes on in this building?
I'm more surprised at the number of people who watch it and listen to it. And the response you're going to get from this show is going to probably surprise you. I think a lot of people understand that something's going on. Many people understand exactly what's going on, and an awful lot of people have no idea what's going on. They just know that they understand when we pass a law that affects them, and then they get involved. But I think most of the public is beginning to understand that we're here. Many don't agree with what we do yet.
Stephanie also spoke with District 17 Councilman Glenn Stuckel. He's been on the council since its inception and talked about his role in the position.
Do you see your role mostly as answering those calls and being that person that people in your district can contact, or do you see it more of being a legislator?
Well, the legislation, we have to review all of the ordinances and write the ordinances. That's a very fundamental part because we are the legislative body of the metro government. But my job primarily is to answer the needs of the constituents in my area. And so when they call with concerns, we do respond. And some people would say that it's a reactionary type operation, but that's not really true. There, at the same time, hopefully, I have the vision and the insight to see what the problems are going to be. And you know, it is either introduce legislation or come up with ideas about how we meet those problems.
Do you think people, because I think we would agree that most people in the community pay the most attention to Metro Council when there are those large issues like the smoking ban and the animal ordinance and things like that. Do you think when they are paying attention to those news reports, do you think they get an accurate picture of what Metro Council is like?
I don't think they get an accurate picture primarily because those are divisive type issues and people take emotional and take sides. However, most of the work that we've done, 99% of the time, we're in concert about how to do things and cooperate extremely well. And that's the way that you get things done. We do have some of the issues like the smoking ban and the animal ordinance that have a lot of, you know, they're far more complicated than they seem on the surface. And it's that complication that makes, you know, for the debate that goes on and takes all the time.
When it comes down to those types of things that are divisive, like you said, do you think because I would imagine from people reading news stories and watching on Metro TV that the council would seem a little partisan. Do you think the council works effectively at overcoming that?
For the most part, yes. There are certain items, you know, or certain issues that spark a different reaction from the person, and it depends on what their district is. And each of us are there to serve our districts, and so that is paramount in our minds. But at the same time, each of us have an idea about what government should be and what it should be doing, and those are where the sticking points become.
Do you think Metro Council is kind of, because a lot of council members that I've talked to have said, and this is one of the joys you get in being the last one that I've interviewed, but a lot of people have said, you know, that the council maybe isn't working as effectively as it could, but it's constantly growing and learning better ways to work and things like that. Do you agree?
I think I agree with that, what would be the term? We're getting more experience. We're becoming more mature in our outlook about the way things should happen. And as I said before, we, you know, for the most part, 99% of the time, we're on the same page.
District 18 Councilwoman Julie Rocky Adams has extensive experience working in government. Adams told Stephanie she thinks merger is working well for Louisville.
My sense is that everybody is very satisfied with merger. Before, you know, I hear a lot of anecdotal, you know, type evidence where people said, you know, I didn't know where to go before. I didn't know what to do. And now, you know, they really have kind of their person on the ground that they can call and get things done. So I think is from, you know, my perspective, from a District 18 perspective, I think people are really positive that merger has been a good thing and they're excited about it.
Do you think maybe procedurally when it comes down to the big votes and the big issues on the council, do you think the council is polarized?
I think that, and I believe this with all of my heart and soul, that a two-party system is actually better for a community than a one-party domination, because there are benefits in the competition of ideas. And when ideas compete and people discuss, and, you know, it may be uncomfortable for some to see bickering back and forth or a partisanship, some like to call it, that's actually better for the community because, you know, we get something that I think is more and better thought out.
In those exchanging of ideas, and I know a lot of that work is not done in the meeting. It's not done on Metro TV. It's done in the hallways and in offices in this building. When that's going on, do you find that there are some council members who are more persuasive and who can win those votes to their side, and who might some of those members be?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that depending on the issue, you will see different leaders emerge. I think that one of the strengths of this council is that we have a broad range of perspectives. We have obviously women and men. We have blacks and whites. We have businessmen, teachers, firemen. You know, we kind of run the gamut. So I think that depending on the issue is kind of depends on who kind of takes a leadership role. I will also say that that I have been very impressed with the people that I work with on a personal level, because I have very rarely found that anybody gets upset with the person. So on that, I've been very pleased on that kind of just a deeply personal level. I think everybody's okay. And they don't expect you to agree all the time. So it's been positive, I believe.
But when it does come down to those times that, you know, where it is in the meeting and it's being hashed out and hashed out and it's taken a long time and it's taken several votes.
Good job,
I mean, well, that, and I mean, I can think, you know, there have been others, you know, that last, you know, several hours. I mean, right. Does it ever just get just incredibly frustrating and you just want to bang your head into a wall?
Yeah. I don't think you'd be human if you didn't think it was frustrating. But I mean, that's it. That's part of it. I mean, that is truly just the, you know, hashing it out, like hand-to-hand combat. And that's good. I mean, that's what it's supposed to do. I mean, we don't want everything to last, you know, 3 minutes. We want, you know, to really air out all the ideas and get it out on the table. And I believe the best public policy is made with everybody being and every perspective being at the table.
Longer versions of these interviews, as well as interviews that have previously aired, and tools to learn more about the Metro Council are available at our website, wfpl.org. Public health official with the U.S. Humane Society was in Louisville recently to talk about his new book, Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching. WFPL's Julie Goodwin spoke with Dr. Michael Greger about the current strain of avian flu out of Asia and the threat of a possible pandemic.
If you would, begin by explaining the current concern with the new strain of avian influenza out of Asia.
This Asian mutant strain, H5N1, which is spread across multiple continents, and killed hundreds of millions of birds, have only affected a few hundred people, just a handful of people in the 10 years it's been around. The concern is that this bird virus will mutate into a human virus easily transmitted from one person to the next, thereby triggering the next flu pandemic, the next human flu pandemic. The last time a wholly avian virus like H5N1 triggered a human pandemic back in 1918, it triggered the worst plague in human history, killing between 50 and 100 million people worldwide. Here, Kentucky was particularly hard struck. October 6th, 1918, the entire state was shut down. The coal mines, public gatherings in the entire state were banned by law, even funerals. And this was trying to, an attempt at social distancing, trying to keep people away from another to hopefully slow down or stop the spread of this disease.
And what are the essential elements for a pandemic to occur?
The World Health Organization has set a pandemic staging system. We are now at alert stage 3, which is very limited human-to-human transmission out of a 6-stage staging system. There are 3 things that are necessary for another pandemic. First, we need a new virus because we have partial immunity to all the viruses that we've come in contact. So the reason that we get the flu, that some of us get the flu every year, is because the virus subtly changes a little bit, but it's close enough to previous years that most of us live through it. That, yes, the flu is nasty, you know, you're kind of bedridden for a few days, but we get over it. But should a new strain arise, a completely new strain arise, then it spreads rapidly around the world because no one has any pre-existing immunity, and it has the potential to be quite devastating, something that we don't typically associate with the flu. So, for example, now we think the flu typically kills the elderly, the infirm, small children. But in 1918, for example, the highest category of death was ages 20 through 34. The youngest, most robust members of society were dying from this disease. Similarly, with this H5N1 virus, these first few hundred people that have become infected, over half have died, and the median age, the average age, was 19 years of age. So it's, again, this virus is killing young people. Something can only happen with a new flu virus that we don't have any prior immunity to. And the second thing is that this virus must then jump species from birds, where all flu viruses start from. Influenza viruses have existed for millions of years as an intestinal waterborne infection of aquatic birds like ducks. Only in recent years, only in the last few thousand years, has it become a human disease at all since we first domesticated ducks and other birds. And every few decades, it seems, one of these viruses arises out of the bird reservoir of viruses and kind of jumps the species barrier to affect mammals like human beings. And the third criteria that the World Health Organization has set out, not only does this bird virus have to be able to start infecting humans, but then it has to adapt to human beings such that it's easily transmitted through a cough, a sneeze, a contaminated doorknob touching your face before washing your hands, just like the regular flu. And once this new flu virus from birds can transmit easily from one person to the next, just like the seasonal flu, then we trigger the next flu pandemic, and literally between a third and half of humanity becomes infected. And so even if this virus has a minuscule mortality, 1% of people who get it die, well, 1% of, you know, 2-3 billion people is a tremendous catastrophe, tremendous amount of morbidity, mortality. And this current H5N1 virus, the reason we're so concerned about this one is that its mortality rate is over 50%. Last year was 70% of people dying. Don't even seem to get a coin toss as to whether or not you live through this disease. If a virus like H5N1 were to trigger a human pandemic, it could be a potentially catastrophic situation.
Is it possible to get rid of an emerging flu pandemic or eliminate it early on in an early stage?
There have been some kind of theoretical models done actually out of Oxford and Emory, these kind of mathematical models that suggest if one blankets a community that one detects an emerging virus with antiviral drugs, one could in theory stop the spread. There's concerns about this, a number of them. One, if the virus should then break out of that, that virus may have acquired resistance to our armamentarium of antiviral drugs, and then we have a pandemic of a virus that's immune to these drugs. So that could be a concern. Another concern is that we wouldn't be able to detect it early enough. These models suggest that we have to get this disease when literally only like 25 people are infected. And fortunately, there's a number of countries that haven't been fully transparent. China, Indonesia, Egypt, Nigeria have not been fully transparent about the outbreaks of disease. It's been difficult to get at these samples, to get at public health information. And so the likelihood that we could find an outbreak when it just literally infected a few dozen families seems unlikely. And the third problem is that the same conditions, this virus, would this if it were H5N1, for example, should it acquire that last mutation, lock in that last mutation to kind of go human, presumably it's that close to locking mutation everywhere it is, and it's across three continents now in Europe, Africa, and Asia. And so, yes, we may be able to stop in one village, but that same virus is affecting villages all across three continents and would presumably, given a matter of time, happen other places, and eventually we miss that first 25 people and suffer a pandemic. Is it worth trying? I think it is. In fact, the World Health Organization thinks it is and has a supply of 50,000 courses of antiviral treatment drugs to fly anywhere in the world to do this kind of blanketing maneuver. But no one seriously thinks that it's going to work.
Your book talks a little bit about the fact that we are in the age of emerging plagues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Medical historians have dubbed this time in which we live as the age of emerging plagues. Over the last 30 years, starting around 1975, new diseases have emerged and reemerged at a rate unheard of in the annals of medicine. More than 30 new diseases in 30 years, mostly newly discovered viruses. And the whole concept of emerging infectious diseases has gone from a mere curiosity in the field of medicine. Now it's an entire discipline which has moved to center stage. Most of these new diseases are coming from animals. About 70% are coming from the animal kingdom. So, for example, if you think of SARS or Ebola, mad cow, bird flu, these are diseases that have jumped the species barrier. And you say, well, wait a second. What has happened in recent years? Why now? What has changed in recent decades to kind of bring this all upon us? And it turns out kind of the way we treat animals and the way we've affected the environment can have these really global public health implications. So, for example, HIV, the AIDS virus, has been traced back to the bushmeat trade in sub-Saharan Africa, where the trade in primate meat, and that there's an associated primate virus that seemed to jump species. It's called simian immunodeficiency virus, now became human immunodeficiency virus. And so by butchering chimpanzees for their flesh, we seem to have now birthed a virus which has killed 25 million people around the world. Similarly, SARS, for example, was traced back to these live animal markets in southern China. And so right now, countries throughout Asia are shutting down these live animal markets to prevent the emergence of viruses like H5N1 and SARS that have been traced to these live animal markets. Mad cow disease, another example, where these cannibalistic feeding practices, where we were feeding natural herbivores like cows and sheep, we kind of turned them into carnivores and cannibals by feeding them slaughterhouse waste, blood, manure. And then we took downed animals, too sick to even walk, and fed them to people, and then we had mad cow disease. And so it's kind of the way that we have changed kind of this industrialization of animal agriculture that's really changed our relationship with animals more than it has in the last 10,000 years, these intensive systems. You know, chickens used to peck around the barnyard, you know, but now chickens raised for meat are, you know, tens of thousands are crammed with these filthy kind of football field-sized sheds to lie beak-to-beak in their own waste, a veritable breeding ground for disease. Now, this is an efficient process, right? But, you know, we have to ask ourselves, is it worth risking the lives of millions of people for the sake of cheaper chicken?
Dr. Michael Greger, thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you.
More information about Michael Greger and his book can be found at our website. Join us online at WFPL.org. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with author Kirkpatrick Sale about his theory surrounding human evolution. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Heidi Caravan talks with Leroy Sievers. He's been sharing his experiences battling cancer through commentaries on NPR and a blog called My Cancer. First, though, our relationship with the Earth and its resources is a hot topic for discussion these days. It's widely thought that human behavior is the main cause of global warming. According to Kirkpatrick Sale, the attempt to dominate the Earth began 70,000 years ago in response to a natural disaster. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Sale about his new book. It's called After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination.
I found your book to be fascinating, and it really flew in the face of so much that I've been taught my whole life. And, you know, I find as I get older that what I've been taught is not necessarily what I should be believing now. And I wondered if we could start sort of where you start the book and start talking about the natural disaster that begins the book and the one that you think changed the course of human history.
Yes, that was the explosion of Mount Toba in Sumatra about 72,000 years ago, which filled the skies of the entire Earth with soot and ash and sulfur that blocked out the rays of the sun, effectively, and caused the climate to crash all around the Earth. Most particularly, though, in the places where humans had been developing, the Homo sapiens, we call them, had been developing in southern and eastern Africa. And in response to this crisis, which drove away certain of the animals that they had previously scavenged, and which probably destroyed some of the vegetation that they had depended upon, they invented the spear, and they began big game hunting. This begins around 70,000 years ago, and we know that it's there, because it's then for the first time that we find spear points in the fossil record. And we can also find on these spear points some signs of mastic with which they would have been fixed to the spear itself. And we find a great number of these. And at the same time, we begin to find bones in the caves all throughout southern Africa. And piles and piles of bones. Now, what this means is that in response to this crisis, humans for the first time invented big game hunting. And I say that that transformed them and did so probably relatively quickly, certainly within a century, if not within decades, because this is a whole new way of seeing the world, not merely of making a living in the world, but of seeing the world. And it causes you to develop a kind of opposition to these animals who are now become the enemy, and you have to go out and kill. And killing is not inherently an act, I think it could fairly be said, that is congenial with the human spirit. That seems to be the modern psychological opinion, at any rate. But these people were forced to develop hunting as a central part of their culture. And every day, go out, or at least many times a week, go out and bring down big and, in some case, fearsome animals, causing that furor, causing that disruption, and seeing the agony of these animals day after day. And my contention is that this process led to a sense of domination, that humans had to dominate nature. And it was a rightful domination. They had a right to go out and destroy these animals. That is, after all, the way they had developed to survive. And once you begin this attitude, you are no longer in harmony with the other animals around. But now you begin to have the sense that you are superior to them and that they are enemies. And in no time at all, these animals that used to drink at the same watering holes and walk through the same savannas as people, these animals developed a fright of humans and would run away when they caught their smell. This is a whole different way of humans in nature, and I say a very dangerous way that has led to the kind of human domination that exists today.
So you think that this is a little more than just a survival of the fittest on the part of the Homo sapiens? It seems to me that if we go by that theory, that someone always dominates.
No, not so. Not even the lion as king of the beasts. There are hunted and hunters in the animal world, that's true. But humans, for the 2 million years that they lived as Homo erectus and the hundred-some years, 1,000 years that they lived as Homo sapiens, were scavengers and gatherers of vegetable stuff, plant stuff. But there was no hierarchy. Suddenly, there becomes a hierarchy, and humans work very hard to make themselves at the top of that hierarchy. Indeed, as they go on and develop their hunting culture and get better and better at it, and they spread out into Asia and into Europe, they actually develop societies with hierarchies. And we can see this as early as about 30,000 years ago. So this sense of hierarchy as humans against animals eventually leads to a sense of hierarchy of humans against humans. But that is new as far as we can determine from the fossil record.
Well, take us back a little bit to Homo erectus and give us sort of a Cliff Notes version of Homo erectus and how Homo erectus differs from the Homo sapien that became the big game hunter, because it's my understanding that the Homo sapien and the Homo erectus, at least socially, were similar in the way they related to the earth until this natural disaster.
As near as we can tell, that's true. The Homo erectus was a large human species. It had a smaller brain than Homo sapiens did, but it lived in human groups and tribes, as the sapiens were to do. But it inevitably had a closer and more egalitarian relationship to nature because there was no hunting. And they lived that way for 2 million years. It is the most successful human species ever. After all, Homo sapiens have lived only for about 200,000, a little more, years. But these Homo erectus lived with quite simple technology, mostly the hand axe, an axe held in the hand used for scraping and gouging. They lived successfully enough so that they moved into Europe and they moved into Asia, all the way to modern-day China and probably into Australia, although that's not certain. But it was a successful species living in harmony with the other creatures and systems of the earth. Homo sapiens, because of this crisis, could not live in harmony with the other species. And in order to justify this disharmony, they had to develop the sense that the domination of other species that they were working on was legitimate, and the domination was, in fact, the rightful course of humans. So much so that when they moved into Europe and in the quite cold conditions of Europe about 35,000 years ago, cold and getting colder, in fact, for the next 15,000 years, they became so good at hunting that they were eventually able to wipe out entire species. And that is an extent of domination that, in the first place, is foolish, but in the second place is a extreme example of the attitude of human domination, so exaggerated that they were able to wipe out huge species, like mammoths were wiped out in Europe, and in not too many years. There was another cold period, and there was another critical time for humans, and they just honed their hunting skills and developed rituals. In fact, it is then that they developed cave art. And that marvelous cave art that we know today begins about 35,000 years ago, and it seems clearly to have been part of a ritual that people undertook in order to be able to go out and get these animals and to kill them. Hunting magic, an expression of hunting magic. But the crisis for those maybe 15,000 years was so sharp that it led to extinctions of somewhere between 60% and 75% of all the large species of the European continent and later of the American continents.
Thank you very much for your time.
Hi, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with author Kirkpatrick Sale about his new book, After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination. Sale will be in Louisville for the Earth Spirit Rising Conference, June 8th through the 10th. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org. When we come back, WFPL's Heidi Caravan speaks with My Cancer blogger Leroy Sievers. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. NPR listeners are probably familiar with the voice of Leroy Sievers. He isn't a reporter or newscaster, but his voice has become one that resonates with many cancer patients across the country. Sievers is a friend and producer for journalist Ted Koppel, and the two have recently appeared in a documentary on the Discovery Channel called Living with Cancer. He's also been sharing his thoughts and experiences through commentaries on NPR, as well as an NPR blog called My Cancer. He spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan.
Tell me a little bit about My Cancer. How did My Cancer come about?
Well, I was doing commentaries for NPR initially on some work I was doing overseas and foreign affairs and things like that. And when I was diagnosed with cancer again, they suggested that I write about that experience and about getting sick. And I did. And the response, I guess, was pretty good. And NPR was looking for a way to get into the whole blog podcast world. And an executive there actually suggested, well, why don't we do it on you know, my having cancer. And we really didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it was going to be like. A lot of people wondered if, you know, they kept asking, do you really want to be that public about it? And once we got into it, it turned into something actually pretty terrific in terms of becoming a community. And I think a place for a great discussion.
I know people have asked you, you know, what do you get out of writing your blog? And for me, as a cancer patient, just sharing with other people is very therapeutic. How do you feel about it?
Well, it's funny. I think most people expect me to say that it's cathartic for me and all of that. I actually am sitting in front of my computer now just finishing up the one for tomorrow. It really isn't that way in the sense that I haven't had a problem talking about it, but what it does do is make me sit and, you know, for an hour or so each day and think about my cancer and sort of stop and reflect on it. And there's some days where that's all fine. There are some days where I just don't want to do that. You know, you want a little denial every now and then. But it's there and it's something I do every day. What's interesting, and we notice it almost from the beginning, is a lot of people will write in and not respond to something that I've said, but simply tell their stories. They'll simply say, this is, you know, who I am, and this is what's happened to me. And those always make me a little sad, because I wonder if they don't have another place that they can say that.
You've said that you don't like the term survivor. Why is that?
Well, when I was first diagnosed with colon cancer back in 2001, and I had surgery, and I was a poster child for early detection surgery, and we thought I was clean, and I didn't like to refer to myself as a cancer survivor, because that wasn't who I was. Cancer was simply something that I had. We'd fixed it. I had moved on with my life. And then when it came back with a vengeance in the end of 2005, it's different. Then it was much more serious, really took over my life to a much greater degree. I'm uncomfortable with the term survivor now because I'm still in the middle of it. And to me, survivor means that you're done with it, you pass through it. They say if you get past 5 years and you're still clear, that you've survived it, you're cured. I hit 4.5, and all of a sudden I had a brain tumor and tumors in my lungs, and things went downhill from there.
Even now, after the radiation that has taken the tumors from your spine, do you feel now that you're through with it, or is this going to be a part of your life for as long as you live?
No, I don't think I'm through with it at all. And I had 2 tumors on my spine we killed with radiation, and 3 in my lungs we killed with a procedure called radiofrequency ablation. So right now I have no active tumors. There's a blood marker that still is elevated, which is notoriously unreliable, but also indicates there's something in there. I simply believe that, and as do my doctors, there's cancer in there somewhere. I think it's hiding. I think it's too small to see right now. But I have no doubt it'll come back. I think I'll deal with this for the rest of my life.
I think a lot of people, unless they've experienced it in their family or with a close friend, don't realize the procedures that you've gone through. Tell us a little bit about the radiation and the chemo and the brain surgery and the procedures that you've had to go through.
I think I've had just about every procedure you can have.
I love that you can laugh about it, by the way.
You have to. The original brain tumor, and all of this was colon cancer, some of the colon cancer that spread throughout my body, the original brain tumor was removed by surgery, which was amazing. I mean, you always hear brain surgery, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'll be out for days. They actually wake you up on the table when it's done, and I was up and around the next morning. I had a little radiation to clean up what's called the tumor bed in my brain where the tumor had been, to make sure that there were no rogue cells that had gotten sort of into the brain around it. That's uncomfortable because they literally screw your head in. I mean, with wrenches and screws, they screw a metal framework onto your head so they can immobilize you. Radiation for me was painless. I know for some people, and I only had 10 treatments. I mean, some people have to go through much longer, have skin irritation and a lot of problems with it. I was lucky in that mine was relatively minor. I think probably the most painful thing was when they tattoo little aiming marks on you. But again, I was very lucky. I know there are a lot of people that go through much worse radiation treatments than I did. Chemo was probably the worst. It's just miserable. There's no other way to say it. You're sick all the time, and unlike when you have the flu or something like that, there's nothing you can do to get better. You can try to make yourself feel a little better, but as long as the drugs are in your body, you're sick. And the radiofrequency ablation, they sort of knock you out. You're in a CAT scan machine. And in my case, they literally stick a needle into your lung, into the tumor, and they burn out the tumor from the inside. A little painful. I had a collapsed lung after it, which was incredibly painful. But compared to chemo, I'd take that any time.
I totally agree with you there, that's for sure. You had mentioned in your blog at one point talking about normalcy and getting back to normal. Do you feel like you're getting back to normal and getting back to the old hobbies and stuff you used to enjoy?
Yeah, which has been a little strange. I mean, when we sort of determined that we'd killed all the tumors that we could find, I think I was the least excited. Everyone around me was, oh, this is great, and, they'd say you're cured or it's over or whatever, and I was the one person sort of the wet blanket saying, no, I don't think so. I have tried for the first time in a year and a half now, I can work out again. And it's funny, I used to joke that I needed a job, not a career, and now I'm thinking, well, you know, if this is open-ended and things go well, I need to get my career back. It's a strange psychological process you go through. We always talk about it being a roller coaster, and it is certainly that. And it's a little strange when a couple of months ago I was actually preparing for my death, and now all of a sudden I have to prepare for my life again.
It's a wonderful surprise, though, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from your blog?
Oh, it's been terrific. There are people who write in every day, you know, who sort of become electronic friends. People watch out for each other. I learn a lot from the people that write in. I've actually gotten to meet a couple of them and talk to them. I was walking through the corridors at Johns Hopkins, which is the hospital in Baltimore where I'm treated, and someone called my name, and it was another patient, and she recognized me from the blog, and we had a great talk. It's been a wonderful experience. It's funny, and it may sound a little corny. I spent my entire adult life, I don't know, 25 years in television, and most of that time went to bad places and saw bad things happening to other people. And when I left network television, I really wanted to find a way to go do something. I sort of wanted to atone for a life spent in television and was looking for a way to make a difference. And I tried working with NGOs and human rights organizations and all, and didn't find the right thing. And in a very odd, you know, one of those odd twists that your life takes, this has turned into that, where I really, it's given me the opportunity and a platform to, I think, do some good. And you know, who would have ever expected that?
Speaking about TV, let's talk a little bit about the Discovery Channel couple on Discovery, as he talks about living with cancer. Tell us a little bit about that documentary.
Well, Ted and I have known each other for 15 years. We work together at Nightline, and he's a very close friend. And when I was diagnosed the second time, he had done the Tuesdays with Maury broadcasts for Nightline, and he raised the idea with me of doing a series of interviews as I went through this process and agreed to do it. And quite honestly, both of us expected that this program, whatever it turned into, would air after my death. And since that's not imminent at this point, it turned into, is really focused on my case on NPR, on the blog, on the people who write in, on my medical team. I never liked being in front of the camera. I was always much happier behind. But in this case, that's sort of the direction it took.
Did it seem unusual, yourself and Ted Koppel, you had this relationship of covering news events, and now all of a sudden he's covering you as the story. How odd did that seem?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm always used to, you know, look, it's much easier to cover a story about somebody else than yourself, and especially, you know, I never expected to be the story. You know, Ted and I have gone through a lot. There were times when we both thought that you know, our deaths were imminent, that you know, we were together in Iraq and Kosovo and Somalia and places like that. This is very different. And in some ways, he's seen me. I mean, we lived together in the same car for 5 weeks during the invasion of Iraq. In the course of this, he's seen me in ways that he never did before. I mean, he came up and, you know, was there when I went through the chemo process, the five-hour injection. That's different. And it's hard, as easy as it is for the two of us to talk, and I think really what it is simply two friends talking, he's had to face my death as well, or the idea of my death, and that's been very difficult for him.
You give strength to people, though, to, you know, the people around you and also other people who see this kind of thing, see the documentary, A Couple on Discovery, and it's called Living with Cancer. Leroy, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Leroy Sievers talking with WFPL's Heidi Caravan. You can find links to Sievers' blog at our website, WFPL.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Heldet. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.